Two German men with a fascination for World War II history and memorabilia found themselves on the chopping block in the 1980s. Stay tuned to hear how Gerd Heidemann and Conrad Cujo forged 62 volumes of Hitler's personal diaries and almost made millions off of them. I'm Courtney Green.
I'm Katie Reeves.
And I'm Ezra Coopersmith, and this is Swindled and Psyched, the podcast where we explore some of the most successful scammers and hustlers in history, talk about why they worked, how they're still working, and what you can do to make sure you don't fall for them.
This podcast is brought to you by Better Business Bureau, Great Western Pacific. The BBB has helped consumers find trustworthy businesses for over 100 years. With resources like Scam Tracker and online business records, finding trust in the marketplace is easier than ever. Visit BBB.org for more information. The opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and do not represent the opinions of Better Business Bureau, Great West, and Pacific.
So I almost feel bad. I was doing so much research for this, and I was so excited about this story because it just kind of kept unfolding. There were so many things. I thought I was going in to just research Gerd Heidemann, but it became like about other people involved, and so it just kind of spiraled. But there are so many German words in here, and even though I've been to Germany, one of my best friends lives in Germany, I don't know any German whatsoever, so I'm gonna wing it. I know it's something like 3% of our listeners are in Germany, too. So
I'm shocked.
Really?
Hey.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh. Thanks, people in Germany, for listening. Wow.
I am
awesome.
Like the data guru, and apparently I haven't been sharing data with the rest of the team.
No, I have no idea how many people are listening or – but that's okay.
That's insane. That just made my day that there are people on the other side of the world listening to our podcast.
13 different countries listen to this podcast right now. Ooh, so I'll have to send you that. I feel bad for not sharing that now.
I mean, listen, I have fun doing it. So even if, to me, I just think even if this gets sent into a void that no one listens to, it was fun.
Yeah, at least we get to meet up and talk about scams.
Yeah.
The S word.
Oh, careful.
Cool it, Ezra. Come on.
Talk about
my ears.
Bamboozles. Bamboozlings.
Well, this story is super fun, and I had a great time. I even messaged both Katie and Ezra yesterday, and I was like, holy cow, I forget sometimes how much I love doing the research for this. I hadn't done research in months. I had planned so many in advance and done all the research for so many that I've just been kind of going off of old research, and this one I did yesterday, and I am very pleased with it. So I'm going to roll in because this
Let's
is a really
do
good
it.
One. So in 1983, Gerd Heidemann, a journalist for Stern, which is the German equivalent of the Times for the United States listeners, was on the chopping block. So let's back up a little bit. Gerd was born in Hamburg, Germany in 1931. During the rise of Hitler, Gerd's parents considered themselves apolitical, but like most young boys at the time, Gerd joined Hitler's youth. If you've ever seen Jojo Rabbit, I'm kind of like picturing this for him a little bit, not with the Hitler imaginary friend, but kind of like the rest of it. But after the war, he trained as an electrician, but had this kind of lingering interest in photography that quickly turned into his key to working for some of the top publications in Germany. When he was 20 years old, he started to work for Stern. At 30 years old, he was covering wars and hostilities across Africa and the Middle East. Many of his colleagues would call him the Bloodhound because he would become obsessed with these stories and ultimately didn't know when to call it quit. All right, so now we kind of have to hop over to Conrad Cujo. He was born in 1938 in East Germany. His parents were super active in the Nazi Party. The defeat and suicide of Hitler didn't hinder his enthusiasm for the Nazi cause. So for decades, Conrad held menial jobs, served time for petty theft, kind of just like was on the rocky road. And it wasn't really a surprise for anybody when Conrad and his wife fell on really hard times in the 1960s. After serving time for operating a business under a false identity, Conrad visited his family in East Germany. What he found was that there were so many locals that held Nazi memorabilia, even though it was illegal. He saw an opportunity to buy this memorabilia cheaply on the black market and then make a profit on it by selling it in the West. Several years later, Conrad even rented a shop to store and keep all of this Nazi memorabilia. So this shop actually kind of, over the years, turned into almost like a nightclub lounge kind of situation where people came to admire this memorabilia and drink. Many collectors from all over the world were interested in spending time here. So this is where Conrad started his forgery career. In order to sell many of these items for 10, 12, even 15 times the amount he paid for them, he needed to forge certificates of authenticity for each item. After his first scheme worked, he started to study the handwriting of several key players in World War II history. It is said that in the final days of the Second World War, an airplane carrying some of Hitler's closest staff members crashed near the German Czechoslovakian border. Hitler's personal valet, Sergeant Wilhelm Arndt, I don't think I'm saying that right, but we're going to roll with it, was killed, and the personal effects he was carrying on behalf of the cause were lost. Upon hearing about the crash, Hitler allegedly explained that in that plane were several of his private archives that he had intended as a testament to posterity, and that it was a catastrophe that they were gone. So here's where it all comes together. Conrad had spent years studying and practicing Hitler's handwriting so that it was almost identical. After some practice, he decided that he would create something that would be potentially impossible to prove that it was unauthentic, and that would be Hitler's personal diaries. He later claimed that these diaries were on the plane that crashed right before the war ended. Supposedly, Gerd Heidemann heard about these diaries and convinced Stern and other partner publications to purchase the 62 volumes of Hitler's personal diaries for $9.9 million. I don't know if I'm saying that either, but it's the equivalent of $3.7 million American dollars, so that they could publish pieces of Hitler's diaries in their newspapers. Of course, before that paper would hand over a dime, they wanted to check for the authenticity of these diaries. Several historians, including well-known historians Hugh Trevor Roper and Gerhard Weinberg, originally signed off on that authenticity, but as the publication date in April of 1983 approached, they started to get a little more skeptical. The newspaper decided to seek help from the forensic team for examination. Initial tests on a few of the volumes highlighted both textual inconsistencies in the presence of materials that didn't exist until a decade after they were allegedly created. More volumes were submitted for further tests, and on May 6, 1983, the government formally announced that they were forgeries. Conrad was later arrested and imprisoned, while Gerd was found to have skimmed money from Stern's payments and was also sent to jail. There was a lot of back and forth during the trial surrounding Gerd's knowledge of the fraudulent activity. While Gerd claimed he had no idea the diaries were fakes, Conrad stated that Gerd actually supplied a majority of the paper and leather covers for the forged diaries. Ultimately, the two only served about 5 years each for their crimes. They were both released in 1987. Conrad opened a gallery in Stuttgart, Germany, and sold forgeries of many famous artists, but signed his own name on those forgeries. Gerd was recruited by East German secret police and is now living on social security and is more than 700,000 euros in debt. He remains bitter about his treatment during the trial. And that is the story of the Hitler diaries.
Wah, wah. That was mostly for GERD, just because it was like, well, he went to jail, then was with the secret police for a while, and now is living in debt.
You know what makes this one a little bit easier is that I feel like often when you get to the end of the story, we're like, well, I feel kind of bad for this person because clearly they were like in over their head and they didn't realize what they're doing was wrong, and then had just... This guy was a Nazi, at least Conrad was. Yeah. So, like, we, you know, you don't really have to have that.
That we can, what do you mean, Ezra?
Just and not feel bad about it.
Well, and it's also very clear that from the get-go, he what he was doing wasn't with an intention of, you know, having doing something good. It wasn't, you know, oh, right. I'm forging these Hitler diaries to sell and to donate the money to charity. No, like this. No.
Yeah, it's anyway. Really interesting. There is still, after all this time, there is still so much speculation on whether or not GERD had knowledge of these being forged or not. And I mean, really, at the end of the day, only he truly knows what went down, him and Conrad. But it's
didn't he skim some money off the top or something?
Yeah, I mean, he was still doing something wrong, but whether or not he knew they were forged, that's true, entirely different. Anyway, I just found this super, super interesting. And there was so much more to the story. I highly recommend the research that I did. I'll put, obviously, all the links in the bio of this podcast or this episode. But I highly suggest people do their own research on this because it is super interesting. Kind of even I didn't use Wikipedia as a source, but I did look at that page. And if everything on there is correct, there's a lot more to this story. But, you know, Wikipedia is one of those, it could be anybody's game kind of.
Exactly.
Things. So I never use that as a source, even though sometimes it's more interesting than the rest of the sources that
well,
I
and fairly
find.
Clearly laid out. You're like, ah, it's like a spark yes. notes for all this information.
Right. Absolutely. But Katie, I have been dying to know what angle you took for this, because there's a lot going on here.
Well, I'll be honest, I had a hard time figuring out what way to go with this because I didn't really want to dive into why are people still Nazi sympathizers? Didn't want to go that route. So I mean, you can, but it's, you know, for this podcast, it's can be very controversial and
right.
Anyway, so what I looked at was the essentially greed, because what I thought was interesting, I mean, let's be honest, was I reading through, you know, going through this story and thinking, man, what great guys? No, especially Conrad. Kick rocks, man. Like, I will say what I think is interesting is it sounded like he had a successful thing going when he had his when he had set up sort of like that bar, people were coming and looking at his memorabilia. He was also able, I mean, it's not great, but he was forging documents to make up 10, 15 times, you know, more off of the item with these certificates. So I was curious as to why he made the jump from doing that and potentially having success with that to then thinking, I'm going to forge 62 volumes of Hitler's diaries. Like, that is a major thing to take on. And he was also seeking, you know, almost $4 million from that. So kind of why was it that he maybe changed from, you know, things were going as they were going, but then needed to make this big jump? And the other piece of it was, why does this newspaper want these diaries? I mean, and I get that they're historical documents. I completely understand that. But it was also like, dang, if I was thinking about like the New York Times spending nearly $4 million on, you know, I understand absolutely both sides to wanting these documents. But I also was thinking about, like, I mean, were they kind of wanting the documents and, you know, getting these diaries, paying $4 million in the hopes that they would be able to really turn a profit by what they'd be able to sell with information? They would have rights to the diaries, or I don't know. So that kind of got me thinking about, and again, hopefully people who are listening aren't like, what is she talking about? This is a very big left turn from what we were discussing. But it just made me wonder how what we're willing to do for money, or what, you know, what we're willing to do in order to garner more profit. And, you know, and so looking, one, at the newspaper, not, and I'm not saying the newspaper was doing that only for profit. I don't actually know, but I feel like that has to be a piece of it. But again, that's also my assumption. And also looking, you know, that big jump that Conrad made. So I was looking into, is greed addicting, basically? Ooh. Can we get addicted to, because, I mean, people do insane things for money. And sometimes, I mean, listen, people do things out of survival all the time. That's not what I'm talking about. This is when people have, you already have everything you need, but there's this drive, this insatiable need for more.
Yeah, it like, goes beyond why? Maslow's hierarchy of needs by far.
Yeah. And so I just was curious about that. And so I started doing some research, and I came across this article written by Leon Seltzer, and he has his PhD in both English and psychology. And he wrote an article in Psychology Today about greed, the ultimate addiction.
Oh,
and yeah, so it was interesting when because I was kind of asking, like, man, how far are we willing to go for money, or, you know, what we're willing to dabble in order to get more?
Well, and it's funny because even the title kind of answers your initial question. Can you get addicted to greed? And
yeah,
it's like, this is the ultimate addiction. Keep reading, please.
And there was a line in there that I liked. And so Leon writes, but of all the things one might be addicted to, nothing tops the greed-laden pursuit of wealth in its audacity, manipulativeness, and gross intensity to the needs and feelings of others. Or, sorry, gross insensitivity to the needs and feelings of others. So I that just struck me as an interesting quote, and kind of feeling like, yeah, people do horrible things on the regular in the name of money. And they may say it's for other reasons, but.
Well, and this one is kind of unique in that I feel like the other scammers.
Bamboozlers. Oh, my ears.
The other stories, the other characters we talk about, you know, they're screwing over other people and taking their money. This one really stands out in that, you know, Katie, like you said, greed is addicting, and there's a question of, like, what, you know, just to make some money ourselves, what impact are we willing to have on other people? And, like, this, you know, to an extent, forging a bunch of documents or putting fake paraphernalia out there, like, at a certain point, it does kind of alter our understanding of human history. Yeah. When you're kind of messing with historical artifacts relating to something that's so,
well,
big.
That's just it's so in big history, Ezra, and so what he did was, yeah, so risky, because I'm thinking 62 volumes, you know, you don't think they're going to find anything in there if they search them that may not line up with. So it just seems like, what, man, why, you already had a good thing going. Oh yes, Courtney.
Oh my gosh. There's a key part of this that I think I need to put in here now that we've kind of gone this direction. And it's that, I don't know if you remember, but Conrad, not only a Nazi, but, like, after the war ended, he was still, like, very much into the Nazi party and,
well, yeah,
and kind of the ideals behind it.
Him and millions others.
Well, besides
but sure,
that point, yeah, in the forged Hitler diaries, there were, like, pages and pages of, like, contradicting information to what we know about Hitler. It was, like, showing a very soft side of him and, like, being in love and, like, very personal. And so
that's like Hitler fan fiction at this point.
Exactly. So in my mind, this is the type of man that all of these like followers probably envisioned him to be. But those who weren't under his spell, or whatever, for the lack of a better word, spell, was they knew kind of what he was actually doing, whereas his followers just thought of him as like the most gentle, kind soul who was just trying to rid the world of evil.
Yeah, guys, that's
so
all
crazy.
Oh yeah.
Well, I don't want to go into politics too much, but like,
no,
that is, and there, that was the reason I kind of left that out, is because that in itself, that little key piece,
It is very interesting, though.
It may make some people really upset, and I'm super sorry if that's what made you upset, but that's part of the history of this story. So,
well, and that also, though, Courtney, like you were saying, I mean, this is separate, but that also helps to explain why people may have or still do find sympathy with him as a human being.
Yeah.
Because it makes him more relatable.
Yeah.
But anyway,
and I think that's also why the newspaper wanted it so bad, though, because it showed a different side of him. And if they were real and that's really who he was, then it needed to change. Like, that changed so much of history. And that kind of goes back into what you guys were saying, that if they hadn't figured out that these were fake, and that would have been kind of more fact instead of speculation, they would have had to change so many textbooks. They would have had to change so many stories. It would have been,
depending on what was in there, and
right, it would have been mayhem.
Well, and I do think we've just touched on another type of, I mean, usually we're dealing with financial greed when we talk about these schemes, but I mean, is that also a type of greed that, like, you're willing to go to such lengths to try and prove to the world that, like, your ideology is correct, or is,
oh, I think,
is
so
worth reconsidering, that you're willing to, like, forge historical documents just to say, in this case, you know, Hitler wasn't as bad as everyone thinks. Like, look at the soft side to him.
Think about that.
Knowing full well, you're not proving it to yourself, but I, you know, I wonder if to this guy that would lend his reputation some more legitimacy than it had as this poor guy living in the 60s still clinging to Nazi ideology.
I mean, I don't know if necessarily it would be something defined as greed, but I absolutely think, I mean, that's just, because that's the thing. Looking at any of these situations, there are so many different elements that are going into this, and that affect you psychologically, sociologically. So absolutely, I think, I'm sure that was a big piece of his motivations for wanting to write this, especially Courtney letting us know that he was writing him in a more sympathetic way, because I'm sure that did line up with his ideologies. And so, but, you know, getting back to, you know, specifically about greed, and there is that financial, you know, gaining more profit, and there's a lot more that comes along with money. There also comes power, access. So, you know, right now we're just talking about specifically the financials, but we know that more comes with that, not just a lump of cash. So the reason that researchers think that one of the reasons that wealth or greed can be so addicting is because of the dopamine rush that you get, just like with any other addiction. And so
gambling.
Yeah. Yep, where it's wanting to get that next deal, that next profit, that next sale. And as you go, things tend to escalate because, similar to someone who may have addiction with drugs or alcohol, I mean, I myself am someone who has dealt with addiction, and I mean, still do. It doesn't go away. Yeah, it's because if it's something you're engaging in frequently, your tolerance increases. So same with your tolerance. If you're looking to get a rush, and you may not be necessarily aware of why you're seeking this, you could have all sorts of other reasons consciously for why. But there's that underlying urge, and that, because it chemically feels good when we do things like that. So To me, I thought that was an interesting element of this particular situation. And like I said, this is just one piece of a much larger puzzle of all the different elements that led to this particular scheme. I won't say the S word.
Well, I do think that that's a good segue into kind of the scam element of the, I keep saying
just
it.
Just roll with
it's
it.
It's just, it's second yeah. nature.
For those who don't know, we could very easily say scam in every sentence mm-hmm. of this podcast. And mm-hmm. so that you guys don't hate us, we try to use every other word other than scam. And so that's kind of become our joke. So if you're just tuning in and you hear us say S word, we're not.
Right.
I mean,
I know what the actual word. I know what the real S word is. Okay.
Yes. Yes. But that's why we would avoid use that so word. Much.
If we didn't intentionally avoid it, we would use it so often that I think it would literally make the listening experience less.
We would get because you would we hear would probably get more one star reviews than we already have.
Oh, Katie says we've officially made it since
heck
we've
yes!
gotten no one star review. But hey, if you're listening on Apple nice. Podcasts, go ahead and leave us a review and a
with feedback if you can. We're yeah. always looking
oh, yeah.
to improve.
Let us know how to
not
get
a
better.
One star review.
Hey, if you leave a one star review, just tell us why. It's probably because I won't shut up. Continue, Ezra.
Katie.
It's probably because I used the S word one too many times.
Anyway, Ezra, take it away.
No,
friend.
But I. So I mean that is this wasn't the kind of the main topic I was going to talk about, but I do think that dopamine rush that you get from making money is relevant to a lot of the fraud that we see, because often that's just the first strategy that criminals will use to try and get you to send money. Mm-hmm. It's hey, you just won the lottery, and if you're hearing that, you literally get a high. And because of that, it's easy to overlook all the red flags. I mean, we talk about this a lot, but, you know, it is a rush, and they're that's at the root of a lot of fraud and the reports that we get about it. But anyway, you know, I was thinking about how this story is going to relate to the average person nowadays. And I don't think many of us are in the situation of trying to buy Nazi paraphernalia and worrying whether or not it's real. Or even, you know, I don't, it happens, but how often are we like buying an expensive painting and want to make sure it wasn't forged? The closest thing I can think of is like sports
oh,
yeah. paraphernalia.
Yeah, I'm like, listen,
again,
if
it does happen.
If there's
but...
anyone listening who can buy, like, you know, fine pieces of art, hats off to you. I will never find myself in that situation.
Right. So again, you know, that happens. Just some due diligence, hire an expert if you're that concerned. But we do get a lot of complaints about counterfeit purchases. Mm-hmm. And those are something that happens. You know, often we look at those within the realm of online purchase fraud, which is, you know, the number one type of incident that's reported to Scam Tracker. But we do also have people complaining that are not saying, hey, my item didn't come. They're saying, hey, this is a crappy off-brand version. Or I thought I was dealing with kind of the name brand, and it that's what they made me think it was, but that's not what it was. So, you know, with those reports alone, they don't add up to that many. The average person loses about $80. I think we received about a third of a million dollars in losses. I phrase that weirdly. The complaints that we get about that come out to about a third of a million in the past year. But we also, you know, it's a little bit difficult to say because of how we characterize these schemes. And it's absolutely a topic that we deal with mm-hmm. a lot. And there are a few things that you can look out for. I guess the number one thing is if you're, say, scrolling social media, and I'm just pulling a completely random brand example. I don't even know if we've gotten reports about this brand, but you see an ad for Ray-Ban sunglasses. Mm-hmm. at an awesome discount. You know, it's really easy to just click on the link, pay your $30, and get your sunglasses. But if you're somebody who does care about getting the actual name brand, you're probably not going to get it. And the ways that you can check are, for one thing, just go to the website yourself. And if it's a real deal that they're offering, it's going to be on the legitimate right. website that you end up on. It's not going to be the case that the only way you can get there is by following that one sketchy social media link. But on top of that, you can do things like, you know, look at the URL, say that it's Ray-Ban, but there's an extra Y, or some other extra letter. That's a pretty decent sign that it's somebody trying to impersonate the brand. And then the last thing you can do is, this alone doesn't eliminate the idea that somebody's trying to defraud you. But if you are working with a major name brand and the website is not secure, that's a huge red flag that, okay, this is somebody trying to impersonate that brand. You should always, if you look at your internet browser, you should see like a little padlock sign or something similar. The URL should also start with an HTTPS instead of just HTTP. Right. But those are some signs that, you know, hey, I'm not dealing with who I think I am. And then the final thing is sometimes we get reports, and actually I've through BBB, ordered some of these products to see what actually comes. Sometimes it's not a specific name brand that is being impersonated, but it's kind of an expectation versus reality thing where what's advertised is actually a much better version of what comes. And the best example I can think of is for months we were getting complaints about this site that was advertising a blanket called the Ultra Cozy Knit Blanket. Knitted blanket.
Was it one of those chunky blankets?
And it's actually... Exactly. It was one of those giant chunky blankets.
They are expensive.
The real version is super expensive.
Like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. Depending on the size, you can get up to like $1,500 for a blanket. Crazy.
They're these crazy expensive... Usually they're like they're throw blankets or they're decorative. And they're knitted. Is it knit or knitted? Yeah. Either way.
I don't know.
Doesn't matter.
Who knows?
The English language.
But they're made of yarn that's like, the yarn is like as thick as my forearm.
Oh, yeah.
And the knots are really loose, so they're...
It's very trendy.
It's an airy blanket, but it's heavy. It's incredibly trendy. They look awesome. And this was like, it cost like $50.
Okay.
When normally you'd be paying hundreds. And what came was this disgusting... No. thing. It was basically made of styrofoam because it was like falling apart. It was this gnarly knotted mess of yarn. It took, I think, months. It took a really long time to come. It obviously came from China. They didn't even send us the right size or the right color. It's still sitting in our Denver office.
Wow.
I bet I have a photo, actually, that I could post.
That actually, if you do have a photo, that'd be...
Send it to me. Let's put it on Instagram. At Swindled and Psyched.
Yeah, I can do that.
Because it's...
I'm sure that I have a photo.
I find it... I mean, it's sad, but also funny. Later, because that's another thing you can find on Instagram or Twitter of people, you know, what I ordered, what I got. Personally, I think it's...
Exactly.
I always laugh when it's... when people think that it's a chair, but it's actually doll furniture. What arrives. That's... Which would be so frustrating. But again, it's kind of, why was that chair so cheap? Because it's for a dollhouse.
Why was that chair
awful.
Only
$3.99?
Yeah, which you could find cheaper chairs on Amazon, things like that. But it was like this particular, like, clear, kind of very trendy. Again, with the trends.
Wow, yeah.
But yeah, it turned out to be a doll
chair.
Well,
and don't get me started on the small items, like for tiny doll things that are like hundreds of dollars, so you think it's the right size.
What?
Have you seen those?
No.
Oh, yeah. So like hobbyists, okay. I won't go too big and or too much into this, but like hobbyists that do all of these like miniature scaled things, if you do that, by the way, please come find us, email us, message us on Anchor, whatever. But I have seen tiny little like plates and like cookware kind of things that look like china, but they're like $300 for a set. But it's because they're like little hand painted things.
Oh.
But you would think that if you're paying $300 for a plate or a set of bowls or whatever, that you would get a full size human size plate. I may be wrong, but yeah, those tiny house enthusiasts or recreators using small scale, please let me know if I'm like speaking out of term, but I've seen those and it's very
and people have ordered
when you find out.
Well, I mean, you know, to each his own, but that would be confusing. And that's I think with a lot of these particular situations, a way we could summarize, I feel like a common thing, Ezra, is take your time when you're purchasing something. Read the fine print. Really read through everything. Make sure things seem to be on the up and up, especially with if it's a seems like a deal like, that's insane. Is this too good to be true? Yes.
Short answer, yes.
Just
and don't always assume that you're dealing with the actual company that you're familiar with until you can guarantee that it's actually the company. Here, I found the photos of this blanket. I'm going to show you too.
Oh, that looks so beautiful.
How it and was we'll advertised. Post this. Okay, so this was the before. It's a gorgeous, for our listeners, it's a
like
chunky.
Maroon.
Yes, like a red wine color. Ooh, it looks cozy. The model is holding it against her like, oh, I'm going to go take a nap.
That looks like a pot holder.
Yeah, it look okay. That looks like a dirty pot holder that is not the same color.
It's hard to see. Here's a close up. It's hard to see from the photo. It's like it's falling apart.
Oh.
You can't even use it without getting
fibers all over you.
Red fuzz all over you. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, yeah, we'll definitely have to post those if you want to see them. The day this airs, I'll make sure to put it on Swindled and Psyched on Instagram. Please go follow us. We have photos of all of our podcasts. We've got cool little fun videos. So go ahead and check us out. But thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to hear more stories about the biggest swindles in history, how they worked, and how to stay safe from them. Until next time.